teachers leading labor insurgencies in Trump country.
The strikes show the superficiality of the narrative that red states, for instance, are these deeply conservative bastions in which something like progressive politics or working class politics is just off the agenda because, you know, people voted for Trump. So presumably, you know, there's just not political space for the type of politics that radicals or socialists or labor activists traditionally want to put forward. And so what I think the strikes show is that actually the big divide in U.S. society is not so much between liberals and conservatives or even left and right in that sense, but bottom and up, which is to say social class.
That's Eric Blanc. We talk with him about his book, Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. It's out from Penguin Random House. Then we hear our 2015 interview with Dale Russakoff about her book, The Prize. It's about the ambitious plan hatched by Cory Booker, Chris Christie, and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg to transform Newark's school system from the top down. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Briannan. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Months after Trump supposedly captured the allegiance of the white working class, a strike wave rocked the U.S. Inspired by the wildcat victory of teachers in West Virginia, teachers in Oklahoma, Arizona, and across the country walked off their jobs and shut down their schools to demand better pay for teachers, more funding for students, and an end to years of austerity. Confounding all expectations, these working-class rebellions erupted in regions with Republican electorates, weak unions, and bans on public sector strikes. By mobilizing to take their destinies into their own hands, red state school workers posed a clear alternative to politics as usual. And with similar actions now gaining steam in Los Angeles, Oakland, Denver, and Virginia, it looks like this upsurge will endure. Eric Blanc's book, Red State Revolt, is a compelling analysis of the emergence and development of this historic strike wave. A former teacher himself and an organizer, Blanc was able to embed himself into the movement to get the inside story on how the strikes evolved. He draws out key strategic lessons for teachers, labor organizers, and working class advocates across the country. He shows how the stakes are high for the success of this strike movement, not only for teachers, but for the majority of Americans. Red State Revolt is an indispensable window into the changing shape of the American working class and American politics. Eric Blanc, I'm so glad you could join us here on Writer's Voice.
Yeah, it's really great to be on.
You know, last week, North Carolina teachers took to the streets for the second year in a row with hopes for a legislature that's more willing to meet their demands. Teachers in neighboring South Carolina also rallied last week. Oregon teachers plan to gather this week. Your book covers the strikes in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona. Why are teachers all over the country on the march?
Really, for decades, but in particular since the economic recession in 2008, public education has been under bipartisan attack. So that's taken the form of really deep budget cuts, stagnating pay, a pretty concerted effort to privatize public schools for the benefit of charters. And this whole offensive has been really, in some ways, masterminded and pushed by large billionaires who have a direct stake in undermining public education and public services generally. So on the broadest level, you can say that the walkouts and the protests are a response to that deterioration of working conditions, student learning conditions, and really just the public school system in general.
Yeah, a kind of austerity program in education.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and first, how did you get into this story yourself? Your mother is a teacher, is that right?
Yeah, my mother had taught. She actually just retired. She taught for 33 years and ended up becoming the president of the teachers union in San Francisco. And I as well had taught for 8 years in the Bay Area before just a year and a half ago starting grad school, which gave me the time and sort of space to go around and write about these strikes and cover them on the ground. Yeah, so but my background's in teaching, and so is my family background in that sense.
And you were able to get some inside information that really helped you to report the story quite deeply.
Yeah, well, I have and had no pretense of being like a neutral journalistic observer in any of the strikes. My background is not just as a teacher, but as an organizer and as a radical. So I was very open about that when I traveled to the different cities and states where the strikes were popping off. And, you know, in some ways, I think that was a real benefit because for the organizers who really initiated these walkouts, particularly the rank and file, it allowed me to gain their trust in a way that I think would have been harder if I'd just been a journalist. So I really embedded myself into the movements, in part because I helped organize national solidarity for the strikes in each place where they took place. You know, things like raising funds across the country through GoFundMes to help provide food and funds for striking teachers. And I think that gave me a kind of a behind-the-scenes view of how the strikes were being organized and what they looked like.
Now, your book is called Red State Revolt, but you say right up in the beginning that this paradigm of red state, blue state is really superficial, actually. And as you already indicated, the teacher shortage, you know, is a truly national crisis. Yet the red states do seem to be the ones which are leading this struggle. So if you could talk about that, the sense of red state and blue state, what they share, and then how things are different.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think actually the experience has been that the protests amongst teachers have been pretty across the board, and it would be hard to say that they're specifically led by red states. In some ways, the first shot in what is the current strike wave was Chicago in 2012, in which the Chicago Teachers Union took on the Democratic Party machine and Rahm Emanuel and Arne Duncan. And, you know, that was an inspiration for some of the organizers in West Virginia that initiated the most recent revolt. So in turn, it spread to Oklahoma and Arizona. But, you know, even just this year, there's been important strikes in Los Angeles, Denver, Oakland, Sacramento. So really, it is more of a national revolt. But as you mentioned, the dynamics of the strikes do look different in, you know, quote unquote red state, quote unquote blue state. I, for lack of a better term, it's fine to use those categories because that's how, you know, the public refers as shorthand to some of these states. But part of the story then is the strikes show the superficiality of the narrative that red states, for instance, are these deeply conservative bastions in which something like progressive politics or working class politics is just off the agenda because, you know, people voted for Trump. So presumably, you know, there's just not political space for the type of politics that radicals or socialists or labor activists traditionally want to put forward. And so what I think the strikes show is that actually the big divide in U.S. society is not so much between liberals and conservatives or even left and right in that sense, but bottom and up, which is to say social class. And when the rank and file radicals, often socialists in these red states, people who'd been politicized through the Bernie Sanders campaign and the New Democratic Socialists of America, when they took the initiative to fight for demands that spoke to the interests materially of teachers and then also for student learning conditions, you know, they got a tremendously strong response. So it really demonstrated the kind of untapped class anger and class sentiment in all of the states, whether blue or red.
Yeah, and they brought together, as you say in this really wonderful book, Red State Revolt, a very diverse movement, politically, socially, and racially. I mean, there was the key role of radicals, of Bernie Sanders' Democratic Socialists, which I'd love to ask you more about, but also registered Republicans, Democrats, and Independents.
Yeah, that's one of the really inspiring and remarkable aspects of the strikes, is precisely how broad they were. Because you can imagine, you know, these were overwhelmingly statewide strikes. You're talking about tens of thousands of education workers, not just teachers, but secretaries, bus drivers, custodians, in what are pretty large states, Arizona, Oklahoma. West Virginia is a little smaller. But what that means is they really, in order to succeed, had to find a way to unite people across partisan divisions, geographic divisions, racial divisions, divisions between teachers and non-teachers in the schools. So yeah, the secret to success really was this emphasis on unity. You didn't have to agree on everything, but you had to agree on, you know, the demands for better pay, the demands for more funding for schools. And that type of movement focused on really specific burning needs for working people, not just the educators, but also students and their families, really resonated, and it proved capable of coalescing an extremely broad coalition, you know, really a working class coalition.
And how did they create an alliance with parents and students in the community, which, as you point out, was really a critical part of this as well?
Yeah, well, there's a few different ways to look at that. Part of it were that the demands that the movement raised and that the strikes raised were much broader than what normally unions raise. So, which is to say that, you know, for instance, Arizona and Oklahoma, the strikes were not just about teacher pay, but were in fact about more funding for schools and against privatization. In West Virginia, the demand was to stop a proposal to almost double the healthcare costs, not just for teachers, not just for school workers, but for all public employees in the state. And so that's, you know, affected a really large number of people. So insofar as the demands went beyond just the demands of teachers, that was one important lever that was used to build that unity. But a part of it was also just very proactively going out and talking to parents, providing services for students so that they wouldn't suffer needlessly during the strike. One of the sort of more emblematic illustrations of that was in West Virginia, and in fact, all of the strikes, the teachers prepared food for their students who depended on free lunch and free breakfast. And before the walkouts, and in fact, during the walkouts, would deliver, often hand deliver to homes, these food boxes or bags, so that students could eat the following day. And so it really made it clear that it was the students who were being defended by teachers, and the politicians, even though they were saying that they defended schools and students and parents, in fact, it was the politicians who were in fact harming the short-term and long-term interests of not just teachers, but the really student and parent population of these states. So the teachers really went out of their way to make that clear. And they succeeded. Overwhelmingly, the public supported them. Oklahoma, for instance, the polls had 72% of the population, and you saw a very similar, if not higher, level of support in the other states.
And in fact, this was kind of a learning moment for many people who had been Republicans, who had in fact voted for Trump. I mean, West Virginia, you know, talk about this contradiction that Bernie Sanders overwhelmingly won the Democratic primary, and Trump overwhelmingly won the general election.
Yeah, well, it's not as mysterious as it might initially seem from the second that you understand that really people and working people in West Virginia, like in a lot of the country, are looking for an alternative to the status quo. And Hillary Clinton was clearly the candidate of the status quo, and the opposition to that took initially the form of trying to support Bernie. And then when that ceased to be a viable option because of the machinations of the Democratic Party, the people voted for Trump, or they didn't vote at all. You know, the reality is the majority of voters in all of these states either abstained or voted for the Democrats. So even when Trump, you know, wins a majority of voters, that it doesn't necessarily reflect a majoritarian sentiment, even on that superficial level, even if you assume that people who voted for him support his program, which is definitely not universally the case. But, you know, the Democratic Party had run West Virginia for 80 years. West Virginia is not historically a red state. It was run up until 2014 by Democrats who were lock, stock, and barrel bought by the energy corporations, mining and now natural gas. So, you know, it's understandable why people would want to look for something different, both in the form of Bernie or, you know, to a certain extent, in Trump, who promised that he would bring jobs back, and people need jobs. So the sentiment then that was expressed through the strike, there's some level of continuity with the electoral results because, you know, it showed that people were really sick of the status quo and want change.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eric Blank about his book, Red State Revolt. It's a deep exploration of the teachers' revolts for higher pay, better working conditions, and more funding for the schools in three states, Nevada, Oklahoma, and West Virginia. Now, one of the things you point out in Red State Revolt is that it was actually easier to get this kind of grassroots movement, mass movement going in states like this, which are called right-to-work states, and maybe you can explain what, quote, right-to-work means, than in states that are more highly unionized and where the unions are recognized.
Yeah, it's a really contradictory dynamic, in part because of the weakness of unions in these states. The ability of rank-and-file activists and radicals to fill that vacuum was much higher than in a place like New York, where I live, in which there's collective bargaining, there's a very deep institutional infrastructure to allow for grievances to be bargained, and there's a really large union, which is a good thing, but in turn, also a very large union officialdom and sort of bureaucracy that acts as a buffer for the type of kind of mass strike action that you saw in these red states. So partly then because of this hollowing out of the unions and general dynamic of the relative weakness of the labor movement, the strikes took a relatively quote-unquote spontaneous form. That doesn't mean that there were no leaders, but that the initiative and sort of direction took place by, generally speaking, outside of the union infrastructure, particularly in the first part of the movement. And so there were statewide Facebook groups that were created. There were a lot of rank and file organizations on the ground. And the question of how to understand this is tricky because I don't think we want to romanticize it. The difficulty of continuing the movement in these states is quite significant because they don't have collective bargaining rights. And so even though they had these very powerful strikes, the question of how you continue the movement, how you build that power, I think is more difficult in a red state because you don't have the same level of labor rights. So in some ways, it was easier to get a statewide strike off the ground, but it might be harder to sustain working class power in the absence of strong unions or collective bargaining.
So you're saying that unions are a key part of this in terms of the institutional duration or strength of the strike, but not in the beginning. So talk about the case of West Virginia. How did this strike unfold and what role did the union play? And then, you know, there was a wildcat strike at a certain point. So talk about that inflection point too.
Yeah. Well, in all of the states, and West Virginia included, the impetus really came from below, from rank and filers. And in West Virginia, the beginning of the movement really goes back to two activists in the Democratic Socialists of America in Charleston, two teachers who were first politicized, or at least first got organized together through the Bernie Sanders campaign. And they did a study group in the summer of 2017 on past strikes, Jane McAlevey's book, No Shortcuts, which is sort of a strategy document on how to build working class power. And they tried to move in that direction in West Virginia. They created this Facebook group. They started organizing at town hall meetings around the healthcare issue. They took videos of themselves confronting Republican politicians. They dropped banners. They encouraged their coworkers to wear red on a certain day or blue on a certain day. And they fought really hard for their unions to take up the fight against these attacks. And they pushed their union eventually to call a strike, even though the union leadership was initially reticent. So in West Virginia, this kind of rank and file upsurge, which then took the form of some one-day walkouts, particularly from rank and filers in the southern part of the state where there's more of a coal mining history of labor radicalism, their initiatives to push from below were successful in getting the union eventually to come on board. But halfway through the strike, as you mentioned, the union leadership tried calling off the strike. And rather than listen, the rank and file ignored the leadership and continued the strike anyways, which made it a wildcat. And they really saved the day by all accounts. If the strike had ended halfway through, it's very unlikely they would have eventually won their demands. So it really was initiated from below. The unions ended up, to their credits, coming on board, you know, and so we should acknowledge that, because as weak as they were, they still provided a level of infrastructure and resources that were quite important for in all of the states. But had it not been for the rank and file, and had not been for this sort of autonomous push, it's almost impossible to conceive that the unions would have struck.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just astonishing. These legislatures that they went up against are overwhelmingly Republican. What led the legislature in West Virginia to ultimately give in to the demands and not only give a pay raise to the teachers, but to public employees in general?
Yeah, well, it shows the power of strikes, that for the first time in years, and in some places like Oklahoma, decades, teachers won. And the reason they won is that the weapon of a strike is sufficiently strong to force even an extremely recalcitrant Republican legislature to listen to your demands. Because if you don't go to work, the basic institutions that depend on you, whether it's in the private sector or public sector, can't function. And that creates a huge amount of leverage that you can wield to force employers, whether state or private, to listen to your demands. And that's what happened in West Virginia. They went out for 9 days, nine school days, almost 2 weeks total. And the same Republicans who initially were ignoring them were forced to come to the bargaining table, and they were forced eventually to concede, because they realized that public sentiment was with the educators, and that the longer they waited, the more the public was going to be turning against the state, and they couldn't continue. And the same in Oklahoma and Arizona. The Republican legislatures really tried to wait things out, and for the most part, with the partial exception of Oklahoma, which was less successful, the educators were able to come out victorious in the end.
And those strikes were illegal. Why didn't the state just throw the leadership into jail or, you know, fine the union a huge amount?
Yeah, well, they threatened to. The hope of the state was clearly that their intimidation tactics and their threats were going to be sufficient to prevent people from striking in the first place. And, you know, the reality was it was terrifying for a lot of school workers to participate, particularly at first, in these walkouts, because, you know, potentially they could have lost their jobs. And the ability for organizers to win people to the idea that if everyone went out, it would be extremely difficult for the state to retaliate, because there would just be too many people to retaliate against. They weren't going to be able to fire everybody. You know, that idea won out, and it proved to be valid. The state did not end up firing people. They didn't end up fining people, even despite their threats to. And the reason for that is that the strikes were overwhelmingly popular, and the politicians realized that had they tried to use that type of repression against the strikes, it likely would have backfired. It would have very likely created even more support and even more momentum from below. It would have made martyrs of the teachers even more than they already were. So the repression tactic was just not feasible given the relationship of forces in the strike. So they didn't end up resorting to it. And there's a big lesson there, because so many workers across the country are afraid to go on strike because it's either illegal or legally very challenging, if not impossible, to strike. And one of the big lessons then of the strike wave so far has been that, well, you can ignore the law when it comes to labor law if you have enough workers willing to go out and challenge and fight collectively, that it's possible to take on the law and win. But you need a real deep movement and a level of commitment to make that happen.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Eric Blanc about his book, Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave, and Working Class Politics. Now, you mentioned Oklahoma. That was a less successful strike, although it still had its victories. What's the difference between what happened in West Virginia and also Arizona and the one in Oklahoma?
Yeah, the short version is that Oklahoma was more of an exception in that it didn't win the same level of demands as the other states, and it was much organizationally weaker. And my argument, which I really try to illustrate in the second part of the book, is that the reason for that was not that teachers were less fired up or less mobilized even, or that the public was any less supportive, but that unlike in West Virginia and Arizona, in Oklahoma, the leaders of the movement, the rank and file leaders that initiated things, they didn't have any experience organizing. This was the first time they'd done anything, and they really relied very heavily on social media and Facebook and didn't really have a conception of what it would take to build up towards a strike. So like in West Virginia and Arizona, the organizers, because they had more of a background as activists and as lower level union organizers, they knew that you needed time to build up for a walkout. You needed a real build up infrastructure on a workplace by workplace basis. And in Oklahoma, the leaders really did their best, and you know they should be commended for their efforts, but they didn't initiate the types of systematic organizing on a workplace level or build up actions to broaden the movement and build up confidence that are generally required and were shown to be required in the other states to have a successful strike.
Eric Blanc, you say in Red State Revolt that the Arizona strike was the most remarkable work stoppage of the entire wave. Why do you call it that?
Arizona, unlike West Virginia, for instance, is not a place where there's a strong tradition or tradition at all of labor activism. Unions are extremely weak. You know, union density as a whole is somewhere like 6%. The union density for teachers is only 25%, whereas in West Virginia it was roughly 70%. So you just have a much weaker labor movement, and it's a state where things are controlled directly by politicians who are on the payroll of ALEC and the Koch brothers, and who, you know, are extremely reactionary and who are deeply committed to destroying public education and pushing people into charter schools. So the context that the Arizona organizers faced was the most challenging. The ability of them, therefore, to build such a successful strike and walkout in such difficult conditions is really one of the most surprising things about the whole strike wave so far, because not only did they win, but they built the biggest movement in Arizona in decades, if not ever. They had 75,000 people on the streets on the first day of the strike, and they had almost 90% of public schools shut down. So their ability to do that despite this deeply conservative context, yeah, struck me as really remarkable.
us what the fight for amendments, where they camped out all night, they stayed out another day on the strike. What was the fight for amendments, and why was it so critical in the success of the strike? And what were those amendments?
The walkout had, by halfway through, forced the legislature to agree to a 20% pay raise, which was very significant. But the organizers realized that even if they weren't going to win everything during the strike, it was important to make it clear that the reason for that was the intransigence of the Republicans and not the lack of resolve of teachers or organizers. So towards the end of the walkout, they organized for sympathetic legislators to raise a series of amendments to this Republican bill conceding the pay raise that would have done things like lower class sizes and a slew of other pro-education demands. And the organizers were able to get literally thousands of teachers to camp out overnight inside the legislature on the park grounds, the lawn in front, in what ended up being the last night of the strike, to really show to the whole state that they were committed to fighting for the schools that students deserved, and they weren't, you know, just okay with getting a pay raise, but that they knew that the schools that were needed required more funding and required more than just a pay raise. And so they didn't win the amendments. They didn't really think they would, because they knew the Republicans at this point were going to oppose them. But by staying out an extra day on strike and raising these to the public and within the halls of power, it really shifted the narrative at the end of the strike and reminded people of really why the educators had gone out in the first place and what it was all about.
And that was followed by the Invest in Ed ballot campaign, which you say was a major advance in labor movement history, really. And why do you say that? What was it, and why do you say that?
Yeah, the movement organizers there pivoted immediately to a ballot initiative, Invest in Ed, that would have funded schools by taxing the rich. And that's really a type of politics and initiative that has been too often ignored by the labor movement, which either has just refused to take the initiative in the fight for funding, or if it has called for increased funds, it's been largely through regressive initiatives like calls to raise the sales tax or just electing Democratic Party politicians in general or things like bonds. And what this did in Arizona is it would have made the extremely wealthy pay their fair share so that the vast majority could have better schools. And it was overwhelmingly popular. It was polling in the 70s%, more or less. And because of that, the Koch brother bought Supreme Court in Arizona last fall, shortly before the election, actually, unilaterally and in an authoritarian fashion, really took off the ballot initiative from the ballot, claiming some sort of nominal inconsistencies in some of the language, but it was you know, really a trumped up pretext to be able to get this initiative off the ballot because they knew it would win. And, you know, it was a real blow that Arizona movement is still trying to recover from. But at a minimum, you can say that the idea of taxing the rich by funding education is and was a very important step forward. And the question is how to go about in a new context, or maybe through a new type of initiative, winning that in Arizona, but really across the country.
Yeah, and then this just points up another really critical issue or development, really, that these struggles to defend public education really have much larger political implications. And I wonder if you could draw that out a bit.
Yeah, the context is important, which is to say that these strikes take place after more or less four decades of one-sided class war of big business against working people in the United States. And so you've seen a real decline of the labor movement. You've seen a dramatic increase in inequality. the decline in the size and strength of labor unions. And the implications then of the strike wave in this context is particularly important because it poses for the first time the ability to really reverse this dominant form of neoliberalism that has decimated living conditions for the majority of people in this country. So the stakes are really high because if educators are able to reverse austerity in public schools, that in turn will very likely make it so that other workers will want to do similar things. They'll want to replicate the successes of educators and fight for their own rights, fight for own better working conditions, better wages, things like that. And by bringing the strike back on the table as a viable weapon, that has all sorts of implications for the struggle, whether it's Medicare for All or the Green New Deal or fight for immigrant rights. The question of rebuilding a workers' movement in order to win these demands, which have been and remain overwhelmingly popular. So what's new is not that all of a sudden people are supporting these demands. You know, in some ways, these demands have had majoritarian support for a very long time. But what's new is for the first time, there's a movement emerging that is posing a perspective for how to win them. And I would say that maybe lastly, the strikes have played an important role in raising expectations of what is possible. So on the one hand, if educators are able to win better schools, then you can understand why in turn the level of eagerness to fight for something like a Green New Deal or Medicare for All will similarly increase because people say, well, if they did it in public schools, why can't we do that in energy? Why can't we do that for healthcare? And the inverse of that is that privatizers and the big corporations behind both parties understand that if they're able to destroy public education, that's really going to dramatically lower people's expectations for what they deserve, because public education is the last real bastion of the public sector in this country. It's one of the last things that most people feel that is a right that they deserve to be provided by the government. And if they're able to privatize that and end people's expectations in this right being provided, that is going to make it much harder to fight, not just for a decent education, but for really anything decent from the government, because people can be resigned to accepting what the corporations impose on them. So the stakes, I think, in that sense are very high in this education battle, not just for education, but for, you know, working class people more broadly.
That's a very potent reason that we should all support those strikes.
Yeah, I mean, the stakes are high. So if you hear about teachers going on strike, not only in your region, but, you know, anywhere in the country, every single one of the strikes, when they've happened, there's been initiatives nationally to support them. You can donate money, you can donate food, you can share on social media. You know, all of those things make a big difference. And people who are on strike, I can attest to, really do pay attention to the level of support they get from the public and across the country and across the state. It makes a big difference for morale, for their ability to keep on fighting. So yeah, the support from non-teachers is pretty critical.
We can send pizza. That was a big deal in West Virginia, right?
Yeah. So in West Virginia, hundreds of pizzas were sent at a real crucial part of the strike. And more recently in Los Angeles, there was tacos or fundraised to give to teachers and strikers. In Denver, it was tamales. In Oakland, it was an initiative called Bread for Ed, raised almost $200,000, initiated by the East Bay Democratic Socialists of America. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to support. A lot of it has to do with providing food for strikers, which is an important part of any strike. But there's a lot of ways to show your support.
Well, that's great. And one of them is for people to read this really wonderful book, Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Eric Blank, it's just been such a delight to talk with you about this important book.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Eric Blank. You can read an excerpt from Red State Revolt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Cory Booker, Chris Christie, Mark Zuckerberg, and the effort to transform Newark's public schools from the top down. Stay tuned after the break.
up in the morning and out to school.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Senator Cory Booker is running for president. But before he was in the U.S. Senate, Booker was mayor of Newark, New Jersey. Back in 2015, we spoke with journalist Dale Russikoff about her acclaimed book, The Prize. It's about the plan hatched by Booker, Chris Christie, and Mark Zuckerberg to reform Newark's school system from the top down. It was an effort that ended up with mixed results and mired in controversy. Let's listen to an extended excerpt from that interview now. The growing involvement in the school reform movement of some of the biggest names in corporate America begs a question asked in the subtitle of Dale Russikoff's new book, The Prize, to wit, who's in charge of America's schools? And the corollary, what's the best way to improve failing schools, especially those in poor communities of color? The education philanthropists, like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, along with a number of hedge fund billionaires, think schools should be run like corporations. They want top-down control and strict accountability. Teachers and their unions are seen as the problem. The solution? An industrial education complex made up of highly paid consultants, testing services, and privatized charter schools. In The Prize, the title refers to Newark's school budget, Dale Russikoff tells the story of how a governor, a mayor, and a business tycoon devised a plan to remake Newark's public schools from the top down, and what happened. The lessons drawn from her book are vital to understanding what really works and doesn't if we want to give all of America's kids a good education. Dale Russikoff was a longtime reporter for The Washington Post, covering politics, education, and social policy. While at the Post's New York Bureau, she covered the New York City metropolitan area, including Newark, New Jersey. She begins The Prize with then-Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Governor Chris Christie sharing a ride in Cory Booker's SUV. During the ride, they hatch a plan to reform Newark schools that soon led to Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook giving a record $100 million to the effort. I asked Russikoff how it came about that Booker and Christie were even in the position to hatch the plan.
The way that this came about was that Governor Christie had control of the Newark schools. For 15 years, the state had complete control of the schools because the state took over the schools in 1995 after an investigation that found massive corruption at the top and severe neglect of children throughout the system. So there was no local control. The mayor had no authority. The school board was only advisory. Everything rested in the governor's hands and in the hands of his education commissioner. So if Cory Booker wanted to do anything about the schools, he had to appeal to Christie for help.
So what was the state of Newark schools then? What was going on?
Starting in 1995, when the state took over the schools, they had been in a state of neglect of the kids. At the time that the state did its investigation and took over the schools, there was a line in the investigative report that said it all, and it said, the longer children remain in the Newark public schools, the less likely they are to succeed. As children advanced, each grade had lower and lower and lower performance on the state tests. And the state had been in control for 15 years, but very little had improved in that time, even though the state had not returned the schools to Newark to try to do better on its own. So that was an issue that was just a tremendous flashpoint in Newark. Why is the state still here when they haven't improved our schools? Mm-hmm. At the time that this $100 million gift was made by Mark Zuckerberg in the kindergarten through eighth grade schools in Newark, fewer than 40% of children were reading at grade level. And in the high school, just a little over half of the students were graduating. And of those who graduated and then went on to the local community college, 90% needed to take remedial courses before qualifying for college-level work. So there was just a tremendous amount of failure all throughout the system.
Now, these schools are pretty segregated, aren't they?
Yes. The city is, the school district is 95% black and brown students. So the schools are, there's just a concentration of minority kids in all the schools.
So this was not just about reforming Newark. In fact, at least in Cory Booker's mind, the idea was that Newark would become, did he call it a hemisphere of hope?
He called it that, and he said that it would be a proof point that districts all across the country could use and adopt the model of what was done in Newark so that urban school districts, the implication or the promise was that in Newark they would come up with a model for solving the problems of education in all urban districts, and that this approach that they took in Newark could then be taken to one city after the next, and with Zuckerberg's philanthropy it could be implemented nationally to solve the problems of all urban schools in the United States. It was a pretty audacious promise.
One might even call it hubristic.
Yes, there was a lot of hubris. They kept using the phrase, "We know what works," with the implication that the people who've been running the schools all these years don't, and that we need to replace them as the decision makers and impose reform from the top down. And that was very much the approach that was taken. Now, they felt that they had to do it this way because had there been, according to Cory Booker and Christie and Christie's education commissioner, Christopher Cerf, who had been very involved in education reform in New York City under the Chancellor Joel Klein, they all said that if you made this an open participatory reform process, it would be taken captive by unions and political bosses and the forces defending the status quo, and nothing would happen. So their view was, in order to serve the children, we have to circumvent the existing powers that be.
You present a kind of clash of ideologies, of two ideologies of how to approach school reform. And I'm not really using ideology necessarily as a bad thing, but one idea being that teachers are at fault, and the other idea, maybe you can articulate the other idea.
Well, the other idea, I guess, maybe coming from teachers' unions, would be that the problems that students have in their lives outside of school make it very difficult for teachers to reach them, and that they would without more support, children can't reach the levels of success and excellence that the reformers are seeking for them.
Now, the first idea, the ideology, is one that's very much promoted by what you call venture philanthropy, and Mark Zuckerberg's $100 million would go squarely in this. Talk about the idea of venture philanthropy, even larger than Zuckerberg, and then how, he was part of this trend, this idea.
Well, in the last 15 years, there's been a transition in the leading philanthropies in education. For most of the last century, the philanthropies of the industrialists from the turn of the 20th century dominated education. So this would have been the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, to another extent the Annenberg Foundation, and the Lilly Foundation. And these have all been displaced as the leading foundations in education since the turn of the 21st century, and living billionaires have become the predominant givers, and that would be Bill Gates, the Walton family of the Walmart fortune, California's Eli Broad, the Fisher family of the Gap fortune, Michael Dell of Dell Computers, and they are known as venture philanthropists because they bring the ideas of venture capital to their giving. They want to see results, and they want to give money in very targeted ways in order to have specific changes in the existing system. they want a return on their giving, and the return is, as they call it, transformation in the way education is delivered. So they're very, very active in expanding charter schools. They've also been funding new teacher evaluation systems that will now, in many states, evaluate teachers based on their student test scores, you know, a much more narrow metric than previous evaluations were based on. And they're, because of the Eli Broad's Foundation has been training superintendents to manage school districts the way a high-performing business would operate. So that's, you know, changes in human resources and development of a state-of-the-art data system that can hold everyone accountable for student performance at all levels of the school district. And so these are the kind of targeted things that they're pushing in hopes of changing education. It's called systems, you know, the approach is called systems change, changing the management systems in education in hopes that if you get the incentives right and the management right, that change will trickle down into the classroom.
Changing the systems, I mean, that's so interesting because it seems like they left a whole lot out of looking. I mean, if you're thinking about systemic thinking, they actually tried to cut the community out of the decision making. And that's part of the system, isn't it?
Yes, yes, it is. And, you know, the community, that includes the parents of the children whose lives you're trying to change. So there was a real problem built into it. But another thing is that by focusing on the systems, the management systems at the top of the education system, you're not focusing on the classroom where learning happens and where teachers actually have to reach children. And in Newark in particular, and in many urban districts where there's a lot of poverty and violence that kids negotiate every day, there need to be tremendous emphasis on what it takes to support the kids and the teachers so that learning can happen in spite of all of those terrible distractions.
Right. And I will be asking you that in a moment about that, because you do contrast this approach to another one that's much more bottom-up in the community. But before we get to that, you know, one of the things I wonder about in this venture philanthropy is giving a lot of money away, but it's also has led to the creation of hugely profitable testing systems, consultants. I mean, in fact, the high fees of consultants were paid during this Newark reform effort became quite controversial.
Yes. When there's a lot of venture philanthropy in a district, they usually concentrate, I mean, they do concentrate in districts where the governor is in charge of the school, say, in like in New Jersey, or there are state-controlled districts within various communities, like in Memphis and in Nashville. The lowest-performing schools are under state control. And so where there's a reform-friendly governor in charge of the schools, or where there's a chancellor who's a reformer, that's where the venture philanthropy is invested the most. And they do tend to use the same consulting firms, and they charge the consulting firms charge top dollar. They're big management consulting firms with education specialties, and a lot of the people who worked in Newark got $1,000 a day while they were doing this work. And it did become a huge issue in Newark. It's a city of extremely high poverty, and the idea that people who, you know, white, multi-degreed people from outside are coming in and making all this money in the name of saving our children became a very hot political issue.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dale Russikoff about the ambitious plan to remake Newark's failing schools, funded by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and promoted by then-Mayor Cory Booker and Governor Chris Christie. Her book is The Prize. Right, and also, part of the idea that you talk about in the book is that money that could have gone to the district schools actually was siphoned off from the public sphere toward the private sphere, not just in terms of consultants, but in terms of charter schools and in other ways as well.
There was a very clear and intentional part of the plan was to expand the charter schools in Newark. And that was because the existing charter schools included two very large networks of schools that had extremely fine results in student performance, you know, in terms of their math and English test scores and in their matriculation to college. And so the thinking was, let's develop more of these schools so that we have more kids succeeding in school and going to college. And that was done, and those kids very likely are going to benefit for the rest of their lives as a result of this. The thing is that they reached a level of 40% of students in charter schools in Newark, which means that 60%, a good majority of students, are still in the district schools. And as students left for charter schools, the money follows them, and so the district schools are in a terrific financial crisis now. They've had to close and consolidate schools, lay off teachers, lay off staff, take thousands of children and move them around because their school buildings are no longer open. And the unfortunate result is that performance in the district schools from kindergarten through eighth grade has gone down significantly. In two grades, reading scores are down 9 points. In two grades, they're down 6 points. So, you know, there's a collateral damage problem that, you know, the sort of excitement about charter schools didn't take into account.
Dale Russikoff talking on Writer's Voice in 2015 about her book, The Prize. Coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Gregory Pardlow about his terrific memoir, Air Traffic. It's about his father, a leading labor organizer who lost his job after the famous air traffic controller strike of 1981 and the impact that loss had on his family. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.